Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Anthony from Califon, New Jersey.
Thank you. Hello, everybody. My name is Anthony Rapone, and I'm a recovered alcoholic. My home group is the Friends of Bill W. Club Wednesday night or Thursday night speaker meeting. We meet at 8 o'clock in Hampton, New Jersey. My sponsor's name is Adam Andrek from Mount Pocono, Pennsylvania. And my sobriety date is October 12th of 2008. The reason I mention those things are those are all things that I found out are pretty important for me to have in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I kind of thought this was what I was told was a selfish program. You know, it was something that, and I come to find out as I spend some time here, it's a selfless program, you know, and it's about helping other people. And what I found was I found a sponsor who was willing to put aside all of his needs and all the things that he wanted to spend time with me for my recovery. And without him, I can't do this. You know, he showed me how this was done. And for that, I'm always grateful. And it's probably starting off from the beginning. You know, I'm one of four children. My mother had 12 miscarriages trying to have children of her own, and they decided to adopt. And they first adopted my older sister, and next they adopted me. And 3 years after they adopted me, my mother gave birth to her own child by natural birth, which they told her would never happen. You know, and I'd love to sit here and say that, you know, the reason I'm an alcoholic is because I was adopted, and I felt different because I was adopted. And that would be an absolute lie. You know, before I got up here to the mic, I asked God to remove from me all the great things that I decided on the hour ride out here that I was going to say to you people tonight. So that way I was pretty sure that I wasn't going to stand up here at the mic and lie. So, you know, my family, there was never a question that I was loved. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I believe this disease is genetic, so I'm pretty sure in my genetics there is alcoholism. But it wasn't in my house. You know, I didn't have fighting in my house. I didn't have the disruption of an alcoholic house that I hear a lot of times come from the podium, you know. So that has no play in my alcoholism either. You know? I always knew that I was loved. There was never a question. The one example that always sticks out to me is siblings can be mean, and they kind of know how to push our buttons when we're growing up. And I can remember my sister, who's my parents' natural child. We were in a separate room from my parents, and she said, well, they're not your real parents, they're ours. And before I could even respond, I heard come from the other room, "That's right, we picked him and we were stuck with you." No question that my parents made sure that I felt a part of and that I knew, without a doubt, I was loved every bit as much as any other child in that house. Which made life in the house pretty easy. Where my problem started as a child was when I had to leave the house. And when I left the house, I felt that there were expectations on me from the world. And they were expectations that I find I usually put on to myself. And that on a repeated basis, I let myself down on what I thought I was supposed to be able to do for the day and the things that I was supposed to be able to accomplish and to what degree. And by feeling that I let myself down, I felt that I let everybody else around me down. Through that, I had tried, you know, my father wanted me to do all of the kid things. You know, everything was available to me that any kid could want. He was active in sports with me, you know. He'd drive wherever we had to go to a sporting event. And I didn't like sports that I had to be part of a team, and I felt like I was part of the outcome for the whole team. Because if we were playing baseball and I struck out or I missed a catch, and I, when the end of that game came, I was sure that it was me that caused us to lose that game. And I was sure that I let every child on the bench down and every parent in the stands. And that was the way I walked around. And I'd make great excuses not to go to the ball games. You know, I had a bellyache every time we had a ball game. So I ended up gravitating off to more single-person sports. I wrestled. I got involved in motocross. I bowled. My father ran a bowling alley three nights a week, so that was made available to me. And again, my father was active in all of that. You know, he'd drive wherever we had to go for a wrestling event. The thing was I always stayed close to my father. That was kind of where I was safe. You know, I didn't gravitate off to other kids too much. And as time went on, I started to find the kids that were like me. You know, and that more started happening when I got a little bit older and I started to be able to see some behaviors and the way that I behaved in the world, because my behaviors throughout the majority of my life were behaving in a manner to be accepted by whoever I was around. And I went to a high school that had, you know, they had what they call this, the heads out in the smoking lounge, and then you had the preppy kids over here, and then you had the jocks over there, and I could kind of chameleon myself to semi-blend in with anybody. But the group that I always felt that I fit in most with was what they called the heads out in the smoking lounge, because we kind of all behaved the same way. And it wasn't too long before we all found the same common solution to the same common problem. And, you know, those were the guys that I started drinking with. And I can remember it came to me maybe about a year ago what that first drink that I drank for purpose was. And, you know, growing up, I grew up in an Italian family. You know, there was wine on the table at dinner. You know, if you were working with Dad in the garden, there was beer, and, you know, it was okay to take a swig off Dad's beer while you're out in the garden. Growing up, I would have also considered my father an alcoholic. Because by the time he got home from work, he had a six-pack of beer, you know, four or five of them out of it, you know, behind the seat of the car. And what I ended up figuring out, where I found out my father's not alcoholic. He may have been what our book describes a heavy drinker, but he wasn't alcoholic, because when alcohol became a problem for myself, for my brother-in-law, for some other people in the family, he was going to set an example. And he put the alcohol down, and he didn't change. Nothing about him changed, you know. Not about you guys, but when I made my very first attempt after drinking for a number of years to put alcohol down, I changed. You know, something about me wasn't the same. That didn't happen for him, and he still doesn't drink today. You know. So drinking with him was okay. When I had my first drink with my buddies, and I remember the feeling that I got was that I had found a key to happiness. You know, all of those things that I felt on a daily basis went away. You know, I could talk to girls. I could talk to people who I thought were socially better than me, that normally I felt awkward talking to. I didn't feel like I was being looked down on by the world. And I wasn't letting go of that for anybody. You know, as soon as that happened in my life, I was going to continue that. And I thought that I had found a solution that the rest of the world hadn't found. And if they had found it, they were afraid to use it. And if they hadn't, and if they knew it was there and weren't using it, then they were just dumb. Because I didn't know that the rest of the world didn't feel like me. You know, I just thought that they all pretended really well, and I was just really weak. I thought everybody had that same awkward feeling, you know. As they say, you don't know what you don't. How do you know what you don't know? By the time I was 17 years old and had gotten a driver's license, I was drinking pretty much daily at that point. Again, my father didn't have a problem with us drinking around the house, so there was a refrigerator full of beer. And it was okay to go grab beer out of the fridge. It got to a point where Dad said, listen, you and your buddies are drinking all my beer, and I can't afford your drinking and my drinking, so if you're going to take my beer, leave some money in the fridge. So that seemed reasonable, so that's what we did. But we had a liquor store at my dad's house. You know, we'd grab all the beer we wanted as long as we were paying for it. But I started to recognize that alcohol had an effect on me that I wasn't all that happy about, and it was that once I started drinking it, I felt good for a while, and then not too long down the road, I started to lose my dexterity. I started to slur. Now I'm starting to look stupid. So, and, you know, the next day people are telling me stupid things that I did. And about that time, somebody introduced me to a white powder that kind of slowed down that reaction of the alcohol. And I found out that I could drink all night without falling down on myself, without my speech getting all slurred. And that was the answer. That was the answer. I needed the combination of the two of them. That was how I drank. That was how I drank successfully. Well, as everybody knows, that doesn't last all that long, and that starts becoming a problem. I had great employers that wouldn't fire me for working 4 days a week and showing up at 10 o'clock in the morning on the 4 days that I did show up. I don't get it. I don't know why, but they kept me around. You know, they probably had more hope for me than I had for myself. So by the time I'm 21 years old, I'm an entrepreneur in this great white substance that that somebody had introduced me to at 17, and I'm drinking on a daily basis. I really don't care about going to work. My parents had long since asked me to move out of their house. I had already been arrested by this point on a possessions charge. Drunk as a skunk. I don't know how they didn't get me for DWI too, but they got me on a possessions charge. And had made my way through that. You know, my trip going through, sick as this, I'm on drug and alcohol evaluation 3 times a week. And my answer to their urinalysis test is to drink a lot of booze before I get there to dilute the urine so it doesn't show any drugs that I might have done during the weekend. I don't know how it worked. The tests have changed a lot, but it worked then. You know, it worked then. I ended up passing through that. Made it out of probation. You know, all of this stuff happened, and I'm drinking, and nothing's really changed. I'm not seeing a problem with any of this. You know, this is all right by me. By 21, I had hit my first moral bottom. I walked into my house after my parents had planned my 21st birthday party to have grandma, aunts, uncles, friends, godparents, you know, all of these people over. And sometime during that day, I picked up a drink. And the rest of my behaviors followed right after, right along up till wheeling in at 6 o'clock the next morning into my parents' house. Because, by the way, I had moved back, because all good alcoholics eventually move back home. I've done it a couple times. There's another move that comes on a little later that's even more bizarre than that you guys will like. But I walk in and my mother's standing in the kitchen just looking at me like, what the hell is wrong with you? And there's a half-eaten cake. There's cards up from grandma, grandpa on both sides. And I never showed up. So that was my first moral bottom. I took a look at that and I said, okay, there's a problem here. I can't go on like this, you know. My life's a mess. So that was the first time I made an attempt. I said, okay, well, the alcohol seems to be related to the cocaine use, so I really need to put the booze down. This is my problem. As soon as I get started drinking, that's where I want to go. Sounded a lot easier than it actually turned out to be in practical application of that. But through my journey as a teenager, I had been introduced to marijuana. And I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I come to find out you guys got like a term for this thing. They called it marijuana maintenance. So, and I participated in that. That worked. You know, that worked. The consequences kind of tapered off. I showed up for work. Through that period of time, I met a girl that I had been... She was a few years younger than me, so I was forbidden to date her, and finally we got to a balance enough in age where our mutual friends set us up. And I started off our relationship on a lie. She asked me if I drank. I said, absolutely not. She said, do you do drugs? I smoke pot occasionally. So meanwhile, I'm an entrepreneur, as we discussed. That didn't change when I changed substances. So she comes to find out within a short period of time that I have, you know, pounds and pounds of this crap in my basement. And she, at the time, is a criminal justice major. So you think that she'd run, right? You know, there's another fellowship that she probably belongs into because she stuck around, and anybody who sticks around with a guy like me for any length of time, there's something wrong with. And she did, you know. She ended up getting pregnant and miscarrying. And shortly after that, she got pregnant again with my now 16-year-old daughter. And her survival skills kicked in when my daughter was just less than a year old. She decided that that the switching from apartment to apartment and evictions and job changes and no insurance on the car and, you know, all of these crazy things that I do when I'm active, this is the stuff that's okay with me because I have one demand. You know, I need my booze. I need whatever substance is making me feel all right to get up and work through the day. And she bailed, and that was good because I've while she was pregnant with my daughter, I had the insane idea that it had been, you know, 5 years or so since I had picked up a drink, and I had that haunting of, you know, a beer would taste really good. I don't know if anybody in here has ever experienced that, but. And it was riding me, you know. And her family liked to drink, and whether they're alcoholic or not, I don't know. You know, it's not for me to call. But they drank a lot, and we were around them a lot. And this is just hounding me. And I had the insane thought that, you know, I can have just one drink. And I mentioned it to her, and we were at her nephew's graduation party. I said, you know, I think I'm going to have a beer. She says, you think that's a good idea? Sure, I can have one beer. It's been 5 years since I've drank. Why can't I have one beer, right? Hindsight being 2020, what a course that started. You know, what a course that started. It took me right back to where I came from immediately. You know, the first night wasn't a couple drinks for me. The first night I drank till 3 o'clock in the morning and passed out. You know, I woke up the next day. I was supposed to be at a motocross event the next morning. Sponsors waiting there expecting me to be there. Nope. You know, I didn't get up. I got up eventually around noontime and had another drink. You know, went right back to that. Nothing changed. And I didn't get it, you know. I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous. Nobody came to my school and explained any of this to me. Nobody talked about alcoholism. Alcoholic to me was the bum under the bridge with a bag and a bottle, you know. They talked to me about that there's people who walk around the world and look semi-normal and try to live a functioning life. And that there's more to this alcoholism thing than my moral values. That it's a threefold disease, and that I'm different physically than other people, and the way that alcohol processes in my body is different, and that once I pick up a drink, I can't stop drinking. My body physically demands I drink more, you know, and that I also have a mental obsession, and that all these weird feelings that I always had were what's described to me as being sick in my spirit, a spiritual malady, if there's something wrong spiritually inside me. And when I have those three things together, that makes me an alcoholic. And nobody told me that. I learned that here in Alcoholics Anonymous. When I sat down with my sponsor, and he said, do you belong in Alcoholics Anonymous? And we started talking about my experiences with alcohol. And out of that, he allowed me to come to my own conclusion whether I'm an alcoholic. By giving me the considerations that are contained in doctor's opinion. You know, he had me take a look at Bill's story. He had me read more about alcoholism, and he went through it with me. And it was through that that I found out what an alcoholic was. But backing up, she bails. My daughter's mother, she for her own resources, she bails, and I'm okay with that. You know, she was kind of getting in the way of my drinking anyway. Yelled a lot when I got home, and for some reason she thought that I should come home right after work while she's home pregnant, and then I should bring food home with me. I don't know what that was all about either, but, you know, these are things that apparently normal people, you know, expect, and that wasn't something that was anywhere on my agenda on a daily basis. So she leaves, and we get joint custody of my daughter, and I want to be a good dad, you know. Probably, I like to think that it's because Because in my heart, I'm a good person. In active addiction, I think it's more about how I look to people around me. You know, I don't like being judged by anybody. So in order to not be judged, I need to be a good dad. Because anything that happened over the next year and a half or so had nothing to do with what I know to be a good dad today. Because I had custody of my daughter from Friday night to Sunday night. And there wasn't a Friday night that went by that I didn't have 6 to 12 beers in me by the time I picked her up. And there wasn't a Sunday that I dropped her off on Sunday night that I remember the ride home, let alone the ride there, with an infant in my car. And it wasn't a conscious choice. You know, it's just not a conscious choice. You know, driven by my spirituality of the way I feel by myself, I'm not calling anybody and asking them to take my kid home. Just not doing it. You know, my ego is way too big for me to call and ask anybody to say I'm drunk and I can't drive my kid. That ain't happening. So God sent me a couple little warning signs. In hindsight, I see them as, you know, a little rear ender at a traffic light with no injuries, no damages. Little stuff that's going, you got something big coming your way. And racing motocross, I spent 1 month a year that I didn't drink. I went, and of course, that convinced me I was an alcoholic. I did not drink for a whole month. You know, I can smoke pot like a chimney and engulf myself in training for motocross and work and everything else and have no time to think about anything. Which I come to find out is just changing my addiction. You know, I can flop my addiction from things to chemical to women to, you know, they go all over the place. So on this third year of this routine, when the fog kind of cleared, I had a roommate who was an active alcoholic, and I'm watching him do what I did on a daily basis. You know, I hear him in the bathroom throwing up in the morning before work, and, you know, passing out with a cigarette in his hand on my couch and burning a hole in it, and there was 50 burns on the other side of the couch from where I sat, you know. And I'm looking at it, and I'm like, this just isn't any good. You know, I can't do this anymore. I just can't do this anymore. And the answer I had for myself was never to come to Alcoholics Anonymous. It was, okay, let's go to marijuana maintenance again. Let's try that again. And I survived 10 years on that without picking up a drink. My daughter is the most important person in the world to me. Love her with all my heart. You know, I still reside in the state of New Jersey because of that little girl. So her mother got into a relationship that wasn't healthy for my daughter. It was physically and mentally abusive to her mother and mentally abusive to my daughter. And she was 12 years old. And at this time, I own a house, I own a business, and I'm going to take custody of my daughter. And her mother came right back and said, well, I know you're not going to pass a drug test, and you'll never get her. I said, okay. Take me 30 days to clean that mess up. It'll take the courts at least that long to get us in. So I entered a motion for custody of my daughter. And at the time, I've had 3 back surgeries. So our medical society believes that I have chronic intractable pain due to these surgeries. I take no medication today. My girlfriend's here. She can vouch. I don't want to take cold medicine. You know, I got a cold. I don't want to take over-the-counter cold medicine. I take Advil. So through this, I end up finding out that I can treat the same malady. I can treat it with other chemicals besides marijuana, besides alcohol. The pain pills work pretty good on that, too. And I had a script for that. Nobody could tell me I couldn't do it. That created a whole storm for me that I had no idea what kind of waters I was charting into, because it wasn't very long before the reactions of that weren't acceptable. Make it really easy to function in life. And it really wasn't working very well on the root problem. And what I found myself doing was was introducing every chemical and every alcohol, cocaine, marijuana, pain pills, antidepressants, anti-anxieties. You name it, it's out there, I'm taking it. And all I'm trying to find is that feeling that that first drink did for me. I want that feeling again, and I can't get it out of anything. Finally, that situation brought me to my knees enough that it was the first time I said to anybody that I needed help. And it was weird. I got a message over an infomercial. It's one of those preachers, and not that I, not a religious person. I'm very, I believe in spirituality, but I got a whole issue still with religion that I haven't gotten through. But what the guy said that brought a chill over me was, we can't do this alone. God never intended for any of us to make any major changes alone. And it brought a chill over me, and I said, there's something to that. And the next day I did the work I had to do to get myself into a detox in Booton, New Jersey, called St. Clair's. And I went in on a New Jersey voucher, which was free, because at this time I'm unemployed. I had another employer who, hired one guy and then had a different guy showing up every morning and decided that he was paying me way too much money to be a bad example for the rest of the employees. And with that, of course, went my health care. So they take me into St. Clair's, and I come up with this whole great plan because I had a drinking buddy who got into AA, and he had been sober 8 years. And I talked with my counselor, and we came up with this plan. I'm leaving here. I'm calling him. I'm going to a meeting. I'm going to ask him to be my sponsor. I'm going to do whatever he tells me I have to do. And the sunlight hit my face, and that whole plan went out the window. And within an hour and a half, I had a drink and a pipe in my hand. It happens that quick. I was desperate enough to ask for help. And with the sunlight on my face, my pride and my ego was back, and I wasn't doing none of that. I got it. Those things were the problem. This won't be a problem. I can handle this. I can control this. So that goes on for a while. And in the meantime, as what usually happens with a guy like me is somebody catches on and tips off Child Protective Services that, I'm not a really good dad. And they came in and took my daughter. And fortunately, her mother had straightened her situation out by then. And my daughter was back with her mother, and that's where she remains today. So at this point in my life, I'm unemployable. All the substances that used to make me feel a part of society and a part of the world have me kept prisoner in my bedroom. Fortunately, the bar isn't too far. It's only right down the street. And I can convince somebody to bring me anything else I want. And I'm in the middle of the woods. It's too far for my family to really come check on me very much because I'm a good hour and a half from them. So nobody's coming to bother me. My daughter's calling. I'm no longer answering her phone calls. Anybody else who's calling me, if their number isn't in the bad phone number list in my book, I ain't answering. I don't want to talk to anybody. So eventually it's about 7 o'clock on a Saturday morning, and I get a knock at my door, and I don't answer. And next thing I know, somebody's walking in my door, and I look over, and it's a buddy of mine that I've been partying with for the last 6 months or so, but he's got another buddy of ours that we grew up with. I'm looking at him, he looks very good, but what's he doing at my house? He says, Anthony, your daughter contacted me through our mutual friend, and she's worried about you. And quite frankly, we're kind of worried about you too. Said, I've known you since we were kids, and your house is disgusting. He says, your dogs are running all over. The house is their grounds for doing whatever they want to do. You got a bag of dog food ripped open in the corner they're feeding themselves out of. And you don't look very well. And so no, I'm all right, And he's why don't you come with me? There's this clubhouse up in Hampton, New Jersey, and it's a whole bunch of guys that we grew up with, that we used to party with, but now none of us party anymore. We got our lives together. Why don't you come up? Check it out. You don't got to stay if you don't want to, but come up and check it out. And I said, no, I got a guy that owes me $200 I got to meet. And he says, really? He says, well, you really don't look like you've eaten. And I said, no, I'm good. You know, I got some oatmeal or something in the cupboard. And they go outside. Next thing I know, on the door again. Why don't these guys just go away? I want to sleep for a couple hours here. And they weren't taking no for an answer. They offered breakfast. It had been a couple days since I had eaten, so that didn't sound too bad. So I went. And I walked into my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that day. And he was right. You know, there was a bunch of people that I grew up with there. None of them looked like I did. And they were all smiling, you know, and they were happy. They gave me a big hug, so they were happy I finally made it there. And I wish I could tell you that was the last time I had to walk into an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and be new, you know, but it wasn't. You know, I was told that I should do 90 meetings in 90 days, and, you know, I was hitting 3 meetings a day. I was unemployable. There was coffee and cookies there. I could always bum a cigarette off somebody. And, you know, somebody half the time would buy me lunch. You know, I met some people. I was introduced to my sponsor. My sponsor started talking this crazy stuff. You know, he's telling me that I gotta work steps and I gotta write inventory and I gotta build a relationship with God. Who at this point in time, my relationship with God, I ditched that guy a bunch of years ago. You know, and I'm going to meet him on my judgment day, and I'm going down the tube anyway. You know, there's going to be golden gates here. It's going to be a tube there, and I'm going down the tube. You know, all the crap I've done, there ain't no way I'm going through them gates. I find out I had a really skewed perception of what God was in compared to what he is to me today. Nobody told me that God was an active participant in my life if I allowed him to be. And that I found a caring and loving God. Who forgives me as soon as I can forgive myself. But I didn't know any of this at this time, and I'm like, I don't think I want to do any of that. And I'm going to these meetings, and I don't, you know, either I'm just hearing it, or I went to really bad meetings. I don't know which one it was, but I'm hearing things like, you know, keep coming back. The miracle will happen if you just stay. Make 90 meetings in 90 days. You know, meeting makers make it. And not me. When I just make meetings, I slowly go insane. And before too long of a period of time, I'm in enough emotional and spiritual pain that the only answer that I have any experience with to that is drinking. And I go back out and I pick up a drink. And then I come back in the next day and I go, yep, I'm coming back. I did it again. And I get a... Welcome back. Keep coming. So that's what I'm hearing. And my sponsor's going, dude, you're sick. You need God yesterday. You know, you got to get busy. And I said, okay, well, we'll give that a shot. So I wrote a resentment inventory. And I fist-stepped it with my sponsor, and he started pointing out all these things that I'm afraid of. And how these fears are driving my life. And I'm like, man, I ain't afraid of nothing. Do you know the places I go to? And he's like, no, you know, you got fears that are running your life. You know, some of them are outweighing the others, and your perception of what fear is all misaligned. You know, if I was you, I'd be afraid of not working these steps. That's what I'd be afraid of. And, so we got through that, and then my life had come back together a little bit. I had a driver's license. I had a car registered in my name. I had insurance in my own name. I had a job. Somebody hired me again in a management position. And before too long goes by, that ego and pride starts coming back. And it rebuilds itself. And all of a sudden... It's the great Anthony did all these things for himself because I'm this great, powerful being and I have this type of control. And pretty soon, I'm blowing off appointments with my sponsor to do a fifth step. I had written fear inventory. I don't need to go to a meeting because it's going to be really late by the time I get home, and I got to get up early for work tomorrow. So on this mindset, I hand the key back to the church because I was told that I needed a commitment. I needed to be part of the group. So they told me I needed a coffee commitment, so I took the key. And I decided that, you know, I can't let these people down, and I know I'm not coming back. Here's the key to your church. And my sponsor knew the game was off then, you know. And he's been really good all the way along because he keeps giving me enough rope to hang myself. And out of that, I start to learn how powerless I really am. And he still does that with me today. So that took me out on a... That took me out for another 3 months. You know, it wasn't that one day and come back. And short of God intervening in that, my answer at the end of that I could come up with for myself was that I couldn't stand myself anymore. None of the chemicals I was trying worked. I had experienced what I thought sobriety was, but knowing today the difference, it was abstinence, and it was the worst state I'd ever been in my life. And my answer was that if somebody would have told me jumping in front of the train tracks that I was standing next to wouldn't have hurt, I'd have jumped. I wouldn't be here in front of you today. The next day I was rescued in handcuffs. And I came across a judge who had a daughter who had an addiction problem. And he knew more what I needed than I knew what I needed. And he kept me locked up for 45 days. Come to find out is my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous wasn't a complete waste. While I was here, my sponsor had me learn a third-step prayer. He had me learn a seven-step prayer. And I said them. You know, I recited the words. And from a jail cell, I said the third-step prayer for the very first time in my life and meant it. And from that moment, I wasn't a rat in a cage trying to get out of jail. I came to the conclusion that I was exactly where I needed to be and that there was no mistake that I was there. I had some moment of insanity, and it couldn't have been words coming out of my mouth, but I told my father while I'm, you know, telling him to bail me out, to call my sponsor. And my sponsor's exact words were to him, "Does he have somewhere to go?" I said, "No." "Leave him there. Leave him there. He'll figure out what to do with him." And today I know that to be the most loving thing that my father ever could have done. It was the hardest thing that he ever had to do, was to leave his boy locked up in jail. And that was the true compassion of love. He set aside his own selfish needs to have me out and where he felt I was safe and protected, because he didn't want his boy in jail, for my good and for my spiritual growth. And that was one of the most humbling and the most spiritually learning experiences I had to that point. I learned in jail. I had some great people that I came into contact with that there was no coincidence to me today that they came into my contact, that wouldn't listen to me whine and complain about how it was everybody else's fault, and these guys weren't from Alcoholics Anonymous. So where they came from, I don't know, but they told me the truth about myself and didn't care that I didn't like it. And that's the same thing that my sponsor has done for me over the last 2.5 years. He's told me the truth about myself, even though I don't like it, because he's not worried about hurting my feelings. He's worried about saving my life, because this is life or death for me. You know, and if you're an alcoholic like me, it's life or death for you, too. So when I finally get released from jail, I have this gift of desperation, you know, and it's a God-given gift, and it motivates me to do these steps in rapid succession as if my life depends on it, because I have no question at this point in my life that my life depends on working these steps, because it's the only answer anybody's given me who's been able to project to me that they have felt the way that I felt at that time. And out of that, this man made himself available to me any time that I was willing to be with him. He was listening to my fifth step while he was putting polyurethane on floors, because he does floors for a living. And we ended up moving through the steps in a pretty rapid succession. And by the time I had my second 90 days, because that first time around I did remain abstinent for 90 days, on the theory that I had in my head that on day 90, when somebody put that piece in my hand, everything was going to be fine. And it wasn't. On day 91 was worse than day 90, and I picked up a drink. Because I thought the miracle was in making it 90 days and somebody putting a coin in my hand, because that was supposed to be some milestone. And the fact of it was I was mentally and spiritually sicker on day 91 than I was on day one of that run. So by the time I made it to my second 90 days, I was a different person with a different perspective than I had had. I was halfway through my amends by that point. One of the scariest things I've ever done was my first amends. Because I had a whole list, you know. I thought that this was, I had a theory of how my amends were going to go. You know, I had ex-girlfriends on the top. And I had been in jail for 45 days, come on. And I had financials on the bottom. Because I'm not making much money, I'm not paying nobody back right now. And I had made a couple of amends to family members. You know, it was kind of like where I was directed to go. You know, the ones who weren't going to take this too rough, you know, and they weren't going to be too hard on me, and they were going to pat me on the back, you know. And the next one that presented itself, I wanted to sidestep with all my being, and it was an ex-business partner who I had borrowed money from and had disappeared on. And his daughter and my daughter are friends, and they had a play date set up, and out of that, it was very clear to me what I needed to do, and I called my sponsor, and I said, I owe this guy thousands of dollars. Thousands. I'm not prepared to pay him that. You know, I got my mindset that, you know, I need to show up with, you know, $4,000 and owe him $1,000, you know. That's what my mind tells me. And my sponsor says, well, what's Big Book say about our creditors? He said, says that we make the best terms that we can. And we approach them with those. And we clean up our side of the street. And he says, how much money you got in your pocket? I said, I got $50. He says, okay, you're working for me right now, so I know that you can afford to pay him $20 a week. It's $20 a week. I owe this guy thousands? He's like, listen, it's not about the amount of money you're giving him. It's about that you're repaying your debt. Because next week, you're still going to owe him $5,000 instead of $4,980. I said, okay. And we talked the whole way there. You know, I'm petrified. And he instructed me to stop at the bottom of the street and pray. And I did. And I walked up and, you know, my perception of this, as usual, was completely screwed up, because he gives me a big hug and he's like, oh my God, dude, I'm glad you're alive. And I had and we talked, and, you know, through this, I'm kind of throwing out, you know, I'm doing my amends. Like, he wants to show me his new bathroom, and I'm trying to do an amends here. And he's going, yeah, I know. And I said, okay, dude, you know, bottom line, we got to get down to the money thing. I owe you money, and I'm not okay with owing you money. I need to start repaying you. And so I proposed to him the money that I had to offer him and what my payment plan was. And he said, that's going to take a long time, but okay. And out of that, this is one of the miracles that I've witnessed. Was out of that summer, my sponsor's work dried up. I got a call from this guy, and he says, hey, you, new bathroom I put on, you want to paint it? Dude, I hate paint. And he's like, I didn't ask you if you hated painting. I asked you if you wanted to paint. I said, all right. I says, I can come and do work at the house for you, but I need to have some money to live on, too. I can't only work on my amends. I need to live, too. And he said, well, do this. I'll split with you every day that you work here. Half of it will go towards your amends, and half of it you leave with. The fact is, had I not made that amends, I wouldn't have had a lick of work that summer. Okay? He then, him and I were partners in a mechanical business, and he's restoring a Corvette that he inherited. And I spent the rest of the summer putting his Corvette that he inherited, getting it to a rolling chassis at this point. And he walked out of the door one weekday morning at about 11 o'clock with his computer in his hand, because he was the numbers guy in our business. And he walks out and he shows me a spreadsheet and goes, "You're on the clock now." And through that, I had paid that amends back, you know. But the thing is that I wouldn't have had cigarettes, I wouldn't have had food, and I wouldn't have been able to pay my bills had it not been for having faith that God had a reason for me to go make that amends at that point in time. I fall short on a daily basis from doing that. You know, that's what our 10th step is about, for me to really take a look at what my day looked like. How much did I trust in God today? You know, how much did I allow my fears to drive me again? You know, and this is another part of the program that my sponsor taught me how to apply into my life. You know, I was very close with him for the first year, and I talked to him on a daily basis. And now we talk maybe once a week, maybe twice a week. If he's got a car problem, maybe a little bit more. Our conversations aren't so based around what direction I need to take at this point. There are times when I get backed into a corner, and I just don't know what to do, and I've got myself so far off the beam that I'm just not feeling good, and I know that there's something wrong within me that I need help figuring out. And I use him, or I use other guys in my network that I trust how they work their spiritual program, and to help guide me back and see through the BS that my mind tells me. But what my sponsor did was he laid out, as our book calls it, a kit of spiritual tools. He taught me how to use these steps. He taught me how to apply them to the situations of my life and into the relationships in my life. He let me have enough experience with them to grow faith in them. And then he let me go out and use them on my own and make mistakes. You know? And I make mistakes with them. And sometimes I catch them on my own. I find them in my 10th step. They'll become apparent in meditation. Somebody else will point them out. That comes up sometimes, too. Where, you know, some of us are really brutally honest with each other and be like, "Dude, you're being a jerk." You know, and it's all in a loving way. It's only because they care. And then sometimes I got to pick up the phone and say, "Dude, I got myself backed in a corner. You know, I know that I'm so far off the beam that I can't find my way back alone." And sometimes just sitting down and writing inventory all by itself just doesn't cut it. You know, he'll make me look at things like unmanageability in my life today. You know, that's there. It's there. It's not what it was when I walked in the doors. But it's there if I'm honest with myself. Usually if something in my life's unmanageable, it's because I'm trying to manage it. I have an expectation or a dictation of what it's supposed to be. And I'm trying to manipulate it to be what I want it to be. And that's where I create the problems for myself at this point. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous gave me friends, you know, that actually just cared about me and my well-being. Because coming into these rooms, I was extremely lonely. You know, the people that were left in my life were the people who I thought were in worse shape than me. Because that's who I gravitate to. You know, anybody that had their life anywhere near together, I wasn't hanging around at that point. I just wasn't. So if I don't come into Alcoholics Anonymous and spend those 90 days, you know, we talked about that 90 and 90. If I don't build fellowship about me in those 90 days, I'm still lonely. And when I get lonely enough, I find myself either at somebody's house who's still out there that I'm friends with, or I find myself in a bar seeking somebody to comfort me and understand. And either of those places only brings me back to hell again. You know, so if I spend the time to meet the people in Alcoholics Anonymous and I show up early and I get a service commitment, you know, within the group, and I hang around after and I go to the diner and I get to know some people, I start to find some people that I have some stuff in common with and that I'm comfortable with. and I start making new friends. And, you know, for me not to be lonely, that's important. But what Alcoholics Anonymous did for me more than that was it gave me a way to find a God of my understanding and to show me how to build faith in that God and how I allow it to direct me during the day and give me an experience of the sense of peace, ease, and comfort that comes along with that conscious contact. You know, I can't describe it. I can't describe it. I know when it's gone. I know when I'm losing it. But I can't describe it when it's there. All that I know is that I'm not exhausted. My head doesn't make a lot of noise. I can sit quietly. And my days seem to go by almost without effort. You know, it's just a matter of doing the legwork of what's in front of me. And, you know, and again, it comes back to a selfless program. You know, it took my sponsor putting aside times that I'm sure he'd love to be listening to music, downloading movies, and hanging out with his kids to sit down with me and take me page by page through the first 164 pages of our big book. Show me how to write inventory and show me how to apply the principles of this program into my life. You know, and without him, you know, without him or somebody like him, I wouldn't be here today. And, you know, it made me available to do the same thing for others. And that's where the real gifts of this program have come in. I've been able to see somebody come in here as broken as I was when I got here and be able to just hold their hand and take them down the same journey I was taken down and to watch their face light up and life come back into their eyes. You know, and for that person to grow to be somebody who I can call and say, hey, what do you think about this? You know, I got something going on today. What do you think about it? You know, and I was taught how to do that by my sponsor. You know, that's what he does for me, and that's how he taught me how to do that, by bouncing stuff off of me once he came to the conclusion that he felt that I could be a reasonable guide to him. He taught me how to reach out to somebody else. You know, he told me in the beginning of this that once I had worked the 12 steps, we'd be shoulder to shoulder on a common journey, and that's been my experience with him, and that's been my experience of the best way for me to work with my sponsees as well. We are at the hour. I thank you guys very much for allowing me to come out here.